and she would have to alter her mode of operating. She'd have to concoct a reason to go out alone without an escort, to put down a signal for a personal meet with Ricky Walters and make arrangements for a foreign trip in the near future. That would take a few weeks to arrange. Dominica had a lot to pass to her handlers, and she desperately needed reliable, secure Kamo. She still hadn't decided whether to tell Benford and Nate that she had saved Nate's life in Hong Kong, but for now, she had to get ready for a party. The Georgievsky Hall in the Grand Kremlin Palace was an endless series of massive and ornately decorated coffered ceilings supported by spiraled fluted marble columns at each pier, with intricate capitals and plinths, an ivory and gold arcade of dazzling opulence illuminated by colossal chandeliers hanging in a line from each dome, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them, with galaxies of lights reflecting off the polished parquet floor inlaid with colored pieces of precious wood, set in patterns as complex as a Tabriz carpet from Persia. The room was filled to capacity with the boisterous Moscow Foreign Diplomatic Corps, jostling and carrying flutes of champagne above their heads as they passed through the throng. The oligarchs milled quietly in a corner, each wondering whether, when, and under what pretext their pre-Putin fortunes would be appropriated. The Siloviki kept loose station around the president as he half-heartedly worked the crowd, dispensing an infrequent wry grin or very rarely a lopsided smile, which clearly he managed at a grave cost. High-ranking Russian military officers from the Army, Navy, and Air Force stayed segregated in their herds, respectively green, navy, or light blue, like grazing herds of African antelope, the kudus, apart from the sables, separate from the impalas. Dominica had known Gorelikov would stuff her closet with fabulous frocks, two from Paris, a Vuitton and a Dior, and one from Milan, a Rinaldi. But she had worn the more demure Dior, a silk champagne pink beaded floral print gown with hourglass bodice, ruched waist, and low-cut plunge. Gorelikov steered her around the crowd, making introductions. She already knew the buffaloes on the Security Council and the Secretary of the Council, Dour Nikolai Petrushev, who stayed with her for a few minutes chatting while looking down the front of her dress. Nikolai drifted off when Bortnikov eased up and kept Dominica amused for 15 minutes, whispering in her ear to point out the known and suspect foreign intelligence officers from the respective embassies. "That's the German BND representative?" asked Dominica. "He looks like a Goldavali Bichok, a breeder hog. He cannot be active on the street." Bortnikov pointed to a thin man with white hair talking to a group of diplomats. "The American chief of station Reynolds, capable, cunning, and tricky," said Bortnikov. "His officers are active on the street, but we have not detected their activities, yet." "Keep up the good work," Dominica telegraphed to the American. Suddenly, Gorelikov excused himself and made his way through the crowd, weaving his way around obstructions halfway down the length of the 100-meter room. Russian naval uniforms had gathered at a doorway to greet another arriving group of a dozen foreign naval officers. Bortnikov whispered they were Americans, a U.S. Navy delegation, and there seemed to be as much gold braid and as many chests full of ribbons on the Americans as on the Russians. "What are they doing here?" asked Dominica. Bortnikov shrugged. "Some fool discussions proposing joint naval cooperation against Somali and Malay pirates," he said. "Petrushev has decided we do not have the time or the resources for such adventures, but we invited them anyway for appearances and to collect assessment data on these admirals. Someday we may face them in battle," Bortnikov said, chuckling. Dominica watched as Gorelikov, Petrushev, and the Russian admirals stiffly greeted the American contingent, which was accompanied by the U.S. ambassador and a phalanx of aides, including, to Dominica's alarm, the youthful Ricky Walters, her case officer in Moscow for personal meets. Bogumoy, my God, if he saw Dominica, would he have the wits to keep expressionless? She resolved not to go near the Americans for the entire evening, slightly incongruous behavior for the new director of SVR, who would be expected to get right in the faces of U.S. Navy visitors. The thought tickled an ancillary fact she could not retrieve. Dominica kept quartering the room, cutting the pie like they taught her 100 years ago at the academy, circling in the opposite direction to stay away from the Americans, but to also keep them in sight. Could she dare scribble a note and try to slip it into Walter's pocket? To say what? What if Grelikov saw her? No. 1,000 times no. Grelikov was certainly spending a lot of gratuitous time with the U.S. Navy contingent, handing around flutes of champagne, raising his glass to toast the ranking officer of the group, the chief of naval operations, but then he turned and toasted another admiral who Dominica saw was a mannish woman. Dominica eased through the crowd to get a closer look, and something stirred in her. The female admiral was familiar somehow. She had smiled at a Grelikov witticism revealing uneven teeth. What was it? Grelikov was recommending canapés from the tray of a passing waiter that featured an assortment of salaka, toasted brioche with herring and melted cheese. A snaggletooth. 12 years ago, the Metropole Hotel, the GRU honey trap, the skinny naval student, the biter with the tooth, her shoulder. She had never asked or cared about the result of the snap trap. It was possible, probable, that the black male did not take, for the historical success rate on honey traps was only 25%. If it did take, the Kremlin had been running a U.S. admiral for more than a decade. Then Dominica stopped, frozen like an idiot mannequin in the middle of the hall, jostled by partygoers under the blazing chandeliers, and felt her spine grow cold. The selection of the DCIA. Benford had written to her with the names of the candidates. This one here tonight had to be the Naval Admiral Roland. Her visit to Moscow on this delegation could mean nothing, but it could also mean much. The pieces tumbled in her head like a collapsed mosaic ceiling. Shlikov, naval railgun. She knew who this was, and she knew why Grelikov was toadying to her. Now all she had to do was get word back to Benford to find out whether Magnet liked herring on toast. With no commo, she was mute, and Benford was blind. Grelikov was sitting on a red velvet couch at the end of the empty hall with his feet up on a brocade chair, his tie loosened and a flute of flat champagne on the floor beside him. Dominica sat at the other end of the couch. A few remaining waiters scurried about, collecting the last of the crockery from the 12 groaning buffet tables that had been spaced along the length of the hall. An army of cleaners would follow to polish the magnificent floor and to dust the interstices of the chandeliers. U.S. naval officers are exceedingly adept in unfamiliar social situations such as tonight's reception, said Grelikov, rubbing his eyes. They receive schooling in diplomatic conversation and comportment, and handle themselves with confidence. Our senior officers are krestiani, peasants and plowmen by comparison, hesitant to say anything for fear of revealing the color of the hulls of our ships. It's positively Soviet, the way they act. Dominica wanted to work on him a little. Back then, they were all terrified of Stalin, she said. He purged the entire officer corps in the '30s. Yes, but now, the president supports the armed forces. Old habits fade slowly, said Dominica non-committedly. But who was the female admiral you were speaking to? She was the only woman in the bunch. Grelikov's halo wavered, and Dominica listened for the deception. I don't recall her name. She apparently is a science genius, said Grelikov dismissively. She's retiring soon and doubtless will be offered seats on boards of defense contractors as a consultant. These admirals can manage little else in retirement. Interesting. You don't know her name or where she works, but it has not escaped your notice that she is retiring soon. Dominica forced herself to yawn as her mind churned. If this admiral was the girl Dominica seduced 12 years ago at the Metropole, and if Grelikov had been successful in pitching her as Magnet, and if New York-based illegal Susan was now undetectably meeting her, and if she were selected and confirmed as CIA director, the first thing Grelikov and Bortnikov would ask from her would be the list of active recruited CIA sources inside Russia. Diva Egorova would be at the top of that list. A lot of ifs, but Dominika knew there was grave danger. Why wasn't Gorelikov telling her the admiral was Magnet? Professional covetousness? Orders from the president? Was she somehow suspected? No, they had specifically selected her to meet Susan on Staten Island. Were they waiting for her promotion and a further demonstration of loyalty? Perhaps. Dominika continued to stay away from the U.S. delegation. God knows what trouble would ensue if the admiral recognized her. After a day of liaison meetings with an uncooperative Russian naval command, the Americans would stop in London for 2 days, after which the admiral would return to Washington for more preliminary briefings and to await the selection of the final candidate. Then congressional confirmation hearings. In no more than 10 days, Gorelikov would know who would be running CIA. Dominika frantically calculated if she'd have enough time to trigger a crash-dive meeting with Case Officer Walters to pass an urgent warning to Nate and Benford. Gorelikov, the prescient warlock, seemed to read her mind. "Will you be flying down to the reception at the Cape tomorrow with me? I reserved the Falcon 7 before Bortnikov and Petrushev could claim it. We all have to fly separately. It's a regulation." "This is a mild test," thought Dominika. "Do I fly down with him or show a little independence and go a few days later, try to make a meet with the station in the meantime?" "No. You'll never get rid of your new bodyguards, and you'll never get through to the station. Act naturally. You stick to Anton for now." "I'd be disappointed if you hadn't invited me," said Dominika. "How many guests are expected?"
"Total over the 4 days, not more than 200, said Gorelikov. "But you have your dacha and your privacy. The rest of us can stay in the main house on the presidential wing, elegant but nothing like your own sea view."
"You don't get lonely by yourself?"
Dominika knew Anton was not flirting.
"No, I do not become lonely," said Dominika.
Gorelikov smiled. "I'm sure you will not be," he said. "You mean when Randy Vlad comes scratching?" thought Dominika. When Admiral Roland was first invited to accompany the delegation to Moscow by the Chief of Naval Operations, she almost panicked and declined. For Magnet the Mole to visit Moscow and rub elbows with the intelligence officers who were running her was sheer folly. A little more thought on the matter convinced Audrey that this trip would burnish her credentials for selection as DCIA, and that smooth Anton Gorelikov would ensure that no compromising contacts would be attempted. It would be enough for the Russians to see her across the ballroom and to marvel at her cool nerve and audacity. She accepted the invitation to travel to Russia, sent a short message to Susan to inform the center that she would be arriving, and packed her best uniforms. After arriving in Moscow, Audrey stayed close to her colleagues because she was still nervous about her security. After diplomatic pleasantries with Gorelikov and other officials at the Kremlin reception, Audrey assumed that would be the only contact with her handler, and the danger was past. She could finish her time in Russia, fly to London, then return to Washington to find out if she had been selected by POTUS as DCIA. It would be the most audacious penetration of an opposition service in the history of espionage. She should have known better. The Russians could not resist the temptation to enter her Moscow hotel suite through the door of an adjoining room on the last night of her stay in the capital. The room was dark, and Audrey sat up in bed when the silhouette of Anton glided across the room, backlighted by city lights from the window. Without saying a word, he pulled up a chair and sat next to her bed, leaned close to her, and patted her hand.
"We are very glad to see you," Anton said. "It has been too long. Are you well? Is contact with the woman in New York satisfactory?"
Audrey was astounded that Anton would take the risk of coming to her room.
"Yes, yes, everything is satisfactory," said Audrey. "It's insane coming here like this."
Anton patted her hand again.
"There is no way I could not have spent a few seconds with our most productive friend. We are very excited and expect the best of news regarding the selection process. As we speak, we are working on an enhanced communications plan for you if you are named director."
"Communications better be enhanced," whispered Audrey. "You must not take any shortcuts. You sit here in Moscow reading the intelligence I send you while I run all the risks, and no more Washington meetings with those clods from GRU. I only want to meet with Susan from now on." Too many risks, she thought.
What if someone from the American delegation knocked on my door right now? Gorelikov smiled. We give you full operational discretion to accept or reject any plan or equipment. If you become director, even meeting Susan will become problematic. We therefore are developing a computer-based messaging system that uses an extensive network of international servers, which I believe you know as the cloud. It is utterly undetectable and unbreakable. I'm sure you will approve. He paused for a moment. We were wondering about another aspect if you are selected to the position. I do not mean to pry, but with a 24-hour security detail, we must consider how we can manage your social activities discreetly. Anton knew the day of reckoning had arrived. He was preoccupied with the security ramifications of Magnet's particular sexual proclivities. Audrey's face hardened. She smoothed the sheet over her legs and stared at Gorelikov's silhouette in the dark room. I presume you are referring to my love life. Are you telling me the days of our secret vacations abroad will end? She said. Yes, said Anton. I suppose I am. I cannot imagine any other way forward. That would be, in a word, unacceptable, hissed Audrey in the dark. I expect you to arrange a suitable alternative. The three-star admiral giving orders, thought Gorelikov. We've come a long way from the meek physicist with a daddy complex. Anton leaned toward her solicitously. Audrey, the security measures required of us if you become director will multiply tenfold, and with them will come significant personal sacrifice. When your tenure at Langley ends, your personal, permanent vacation begins. You'll have the money to do whatever you want. Marvelous. And in the meantime, you want me there for as long as possible, right? Some DCIAs have served 5 years. What do you propose I do all that time? You could tend to your doll collection, said Anton, using his hammer and sickle voice. Those charming little china faces, they will all look on you from the shelves in your living room with approval of your professionalism and discipline. Audrey's head came up. You've been in my quarters? Tell me you're bugging my fucking house. Prosnye. Epiphany. It came in every agent's career, the realization of exactly what the relationship amounted to, who was vassal and who was master. It was Audrey's turn, tonight, in a pitch-black hotel room. Whether your quarters are bugged or not is immaterial, said Gorelikov without emotion. You are one of the most prolific clandestine intelligence sources in the service of the Russian Federation. You are on the threshold of being Russia's best American spy ever. What you want and what you do not want is unimportant. I require you to dedicate yourself without reservation and to remember the mission. If that means you must live for 3 years without putting your fingers in the Buenos Aires prostitute, then that is what you shall do. You can't talk to me that way, said Audrey, her voice shaking. Of course I can, my dear, said Gorelikov, pushing back his chair silently. You belong to me. He left through the connecting door, his steps muffled by the sour, threadbare carpet. Dominika's new Moscow apartment was in the massive city-block-long building on Kutuzovsky Prospect, with two outlandish neoclassical towers. The address, number 26, had been the residence of Premiers Brezhnev and Andropov, and party ideologue Suslov. Building security bristled with cameras, controlled elevators, manned checkpoints, and 24-hour valet and food service. Her black Mercedes was always ready for her in the underground garage. Could I tell my driver to follow a surveillance detection route? The penthouse had been beautifully remodeled in beige and brown, with luxurious bathrooms and a gleaming kitchen that Nate would love to cook in. Dominika looked at the outside private line telephone on the sideboard. A suicidal overseas call to CIA's Sentinel number to blurt out her epiphany about Magnet would be recorded at both ends, and she would be finished, but at least Benford would know. Likewise, crashing the gate of the American Embassy to spill the tale to COS Reynolds would forever burn her bridges. She'd become a permanent exile inside the embassy, living in one of the temporary apartments, a historical oddity like Hungarian Cardinal Mindszenty, who took asylum in the U.S. Embassy in Communist Budapest for 15 years. Dominika would grow old, the faded beauty giving Russian lessons to young American wives, unable herself to even walk outside in the chancery compound for fear of snipers. A fine end. She wouldn't do that. Without time to make a personal meet, and with no Shrek, she had no way to communicate the intel that would save her life. As she packed for the reception at the Cape, she fingered the sports watch Nate had given her, the satellite beacon that would transmit an energy signal requesting exfiltration. The beginning of a plan started percolating in her mind. Nate's always trying to get me to defect. Okay, lover boy, come rescue me. Kremlin Salaka. Toast triangles of bread and spread thickly with butter. Lay a bone fillet of smoked herring on the bread and cover with a soft melting cheese like Russian brinza. Place briefly under broiler until cheese is melted. Serve with ogrutsky, dill pickles. Chapter 33. Exfiltration. When Diva's exfiltration signal was relayed by the SARSAT maritime rescue receivers to Simon Benford's desk in Langley, he yelled at Dottie through the door to summon Forsyth, Nash, Westfall, and Gable instantly. She knew he had included Gable as a reflex and didn't have the heart to correct him. She saw how deeply he had felt Gable's death in Khartoum. Benford also bellowed that he wanted Phineas Finn Nicola, the extravagant and boisterous chief of Maritime Branch, the section in the larger paramilitary staff, PMS, that controlled all CIA maritime assets. Along with other ships, Finn Nicola controlled the agency's experimental fleet of unmanned surface vessels, and Benford knew he'd need Finn's cooperation to release one of his precious USVs, stage it on a gray hull in the Black Sea, and program it to retrieve Diva at Cape Idokopas, even though Benford didn't believe for a minute that Diva wanted exfiltration. Her transmission was meant to signal something else, he was sure of it. He just didn't know what. Westfall was the first to arrive, then Forsyth, then Nash breathlessly barged through the door, instinctively knowing this crash dive could only mean Dominika was in trouble. Nicola arrived 15 minutes later, having come from the other side of the headquarters building where the PMS front office was tucked away as far as possible from the dyspeptic director and easily scandalized analysts who were positively allergic to the very notion of paramilitary operations. Nicola was broad-shouldered and muscular, and his tweed sport coat strained around the biceps and across the back. He was known to confront people in meetings by neighing like a donkey, implying they were jackasses. He had a wide, rugged face, an ice-blue stare, no eyebrows, and a completely shaven head, which Benford said would certainly make a phrenologist back out of the room in alarm. Gable had once told Finn to his face that he was half a bubble off plumb, and they were firm friends after that. Finn had volunteered to bring Gable's casket home from Khartoum, but Benford sent Nash instead, certain Finn would bludgeon Gondorf with a toner cartridge from an office copier and throw him in the Nile. Benford wanted Gondorf back alive so he could fire him. The transmission was received at 1100 GMT, which means 1400 on the Black Sea coast, said Benford. She's at Putin's compound for the four-day reception, said Nate. We've got maps of that stretch of coast and imagery. I can show you where her dacha is and the beach below the house. She's got a dacha, said Finn, rubbing his head. Whose Mexican corn did she eat the long way? Nate's face colored. Spare us the knuckle-dragger jokes, he growled. They're bullshit. And you think so? Said Finn. Let's finish operational discussions before the two of you go back out and begin a fight, said Benford. Which I'd win, said Finn, grinning. Both of you shut up, said Forsyth. What do we all think? Does Diva want out? After refusing to consider defecting over and over?
She decided to come out, said Nate. She changed her mind.
Doesn't seem consistent, said Forsyth.
I agree, said Benford. The transmission is a signal for something else.
Do we even send Finn's USV to the beach, said Forsyth.
Nate squirmed in his seat.
We have to, said Nate.
She sent the exfil signal. She'll be on that beach in 3 days.
You guys make up your minds, said Finn. I don't want to send a $4 million USV haul into Russian territorial waters if nobody's going to be on that beach.
Nate rounded on him.
She'll be there, he said. Westfall characteristically cleared his throat.
An observation, if I may, he said.
Where's he from? Finn muttered to Nate, looking at Westfall's fogged-up glasses. Lucius ignored him.
We know D.Va was recently promoted to flag rank and that President Putin has named her director of SVR, said Westfall. She is aware of our intense interest in the identity of the mole the Russians call Magnet. We know only that Magnet is a senior official who possibly is in line for a significantly more senior post. Simon, through a process of elimination, has narrowed the suspects to three candidates being considered as the nominee for DCIA, based on their respective connections to the Navy's railgun project and their ancillary access to information of interest to Moscow Center.
Ancillary? Simon, I thought only you talked like that, said Finn. You following the candidates around, reading their mail?
We have done background on them, which is all we can do without potentially alerting the mole. Go on, Benford said, turning to Westfall.
I believe it's logical to assume D.Va's access has dramatically improved overnight, including knowing some of the unwritten plans and intentions of President Putin. She doubtless has participated in informal conversations during Security Council meetings and shared confidential asides with her patron, Gorelikov.
We're waiting for the headline, said Benford, but Westfall would not be hurried.
D.Va has been without Shrak going on 3 months, said Lucius. We have not seen her since Vienna. She's at Putin's compound on the Cape with no way to meet a case officer face-to-face in Moscow. I believe it is logical to assume that, one, she has discovered the identity of Magnet, and, two, she has activated the exfil beacon, an inconsistent act given her resolute refusal to defect, to let us know. It was the only option left to her.
The room was quiet.
So what do we do about it? Said Forsythe.
You think she wants to use USV as a floating dead drop to send us a message? You know, put a note inside the USV cabin and send it back empty? Said Finn. He was developing smaller USVs, no bigger than a 6-foot torpedo for precisely that use.
We still cannot discount that along with all the factors Lucius listed, she's in jeopardy and wants out, said Nate. That's the exfil plan we briefed her on. We've got to stay on script.
Forsythe shook his head. That's all speculative, he said. The gala at Cape Itacopas lasts 4 days. When D.Va gets back to Moscow, we can have the case officer ready to meet her the first night back.
It'll be too late by then, said Nate.
Westfall cleared his throat again. Finn Nakula made him nervous, like Gable used to.
Based on my research, as Director D.Va now has a 2- or 4-man security detail, a driver, and at least 2 household staff. How's she going to get out alone at night? Said Westfall. We need to get her Hersey's desk lamp ASAP.
How about direct her to start an affair with some Ruski movie star? Said Finn. Her bodyguards will stay in the lobby while your girl buries the pump handle where it won't rust, and she can leave her reports hidden in his apartment. And we go in when he's not home and retrieve her intel. Simple.
Forsythe waited for Nate to explode. Jeopardize the source by getting her involved with an unwitting stranger and have her leave incriminating intel inside a Moscow apartment, said Nate. It's moronic.
Finn shrugged. Better than what you got now, he said, turning to Benford. I'm not so sure I can deploy a USV if you ladies aren't sure there will be anyone on the beach.
Nate leaned forward. What if I can guarantee there'll be someone to take aboard?
Tell me your thoughts, Nash, said Benford. So we can brief the medics on the nature of your derangement when we call them to escort you to the infirmary.
Listen, Simon, Lucius is right. Domi knows who Magnet is. She may or may not want a defect, but we've got to contact her. I can sneak into that compound, get her alone, and see what's up.
How do you propose to penetrate the private preserve of the President of the Russian Federation during an exclusive levee?
Domi told me there's a bunch of young Polish art restorers working in the mansion. They're always coming and going. We can whip up ID for me as a Polish art student. My Russian will get me through. I can be in and out in 2 days.
Benford shook his head.
Implausible, rash, unconvincing, out of the question, Benford said. They'll wrap you up at the front gate.
Not if I arrive with other genuine art experts and native Poles.
Tell me, said Benford.
Nate turned to Forsythe.
Tom, Agnes Krawczyk lives in L.A.
One of your old Wolverines. She's an art restorer, a real Pole, and she's bored out of her skull. The two of us will look plausible as hell. She's still on reserve status, and she can handle herself. We fly in as art experts, maybe in a larger group of students from Warsaw, meet Domi, talk for 10 minutes, then hide on the beach till your speedboat picks us up. Nate looked at Finn. Can two people fit in your USV? Asked Nate. Finn nodded.
Now what if D.Va wants out too? Said Forsythe.
Everyone looked at Finn.
Three people will slow her down, he said, and it'll be a little cramped. Two of you will essentially have to lie on top of each other in a moderate chop for 45 minutes. It'll mean some bouncing.
Benford stifled a wan smile. That will not pose any problem for Casanova here, he said.
So let's give it a try, Simon, for Christ's sake, said Nate. Look, if the wrong candidate, namely Magnet, gets nominated and confirmed in less than a week, Dominika Igorova is the first name that gets sent back to Moscow. Putin and company will be so scandalized and embarrassed that she'll just disappear. No show trial, no spy swap. She'll be headfirst in a wet hole with no marker.
I'll bring back the name, and we keep her alive. Benford looked at Forsythe, who minutely nodded his head. Benford turned to Finn. Can you have one of your infernal machines on the beach below Cape Itacopus in 3 days? Finn nodded. Then, Nash, I suggest you prepare to crash President Putin's party. He seemed amused at how dangerous that would be. Mexican corn. Combine mayonnaise, sour cream or crema, cotija cheese, chili powder, garlic, and cilantro in a large bowl. Stir until blended. Grill shucked ears of corn until cooked through and charred on all sides. Sprinkle hot corn with cheese mixture. Sprinkle with extra cheese and chili powder. Serve hot with lime wedges. Chapter 34. House of Cards. As Nash made crash dive preparations for the mission to infiltrate Putin's Cape Itacopus compound, Benford sat alone with Forsythe. Simon was in a foul mood, introspective, troubled, and heartsick. Losing Gable and Alex Larson had affected him in ways he could not have predicted, and the specter of dispatching Nash into Russia with such slapdash cover troubled him. With D.Va in imminent danger, the outlook was even bleaker. He told Forsythe that he thought Nash might not make it even close to D.Va. She would be in the company of ministers, service chiefs, VIP guests, and the president himself, plus ample security. How could Nash or the Polish woman get near her?
Maybe Agnes can follow her into the ladies' room, said Forsythe, half-joking.
Perhaps, but I anticipate operational ruin, compounded by the possible loss of a star asset and two officers, Benford said.
Nash is one of the best, said Forsythe, helpfully. He'll get through.
The son of a bitch has one advantage. He loves her.
Benford snorted. I assume it did not escape your notice that he seemed to have kept in contact with your former Wolverine. What's her name? Agnes? Yes, well, I suppose there's no reason why this infernal case cannot continue as a menage a trois. It did not help Benford's state of mind when he received word that he had this afternoon to brief the three candidates a final time before one was selected as the formal nominee by POTUS and appeared before Congress to be confirmed. The process would be faster than usual because the president was eager to install his hand-chosen replacement at Langley to begin rolling back what he considered the hyperactive operational focus of CIA under the late Alexander Larson. Acting Director Farrell had it right. CIA should be an information-gathering organization, eschewing dirty tricks and assassinations and whatever other skullduggery they always seem to be hatching. Farrell, in fact, had been promised the deputy director's slot. Everyone in Washington knew he was an obsequious toad prone to vapors, but as deputy, he would be an effective ideologue who would advocate for what he described as a more human face of espionage. Like Mikhail Suslov in short pants, said Forsythe, referring to Brezhnev's hardline Politburo chief in the 70s. As usual, scheduling conflicts resulted in the need for three separate briefings, an infernal nuisance. Forsythe and Westfall would backbench the sessions to provide moral support, briefing Senator Feigenbaum and her mealy-worm butler Farbison
would be a matter of gritting teeth and weathering the senator's scorn and her doughy aide's ready accusations of being lied to. Briefing Admiral Rowland would be a matter of getting through a polite if impenetrable indifference to intelligence matters, if it wasn't naval science she didn't seem interested. Ambassador Vano had seemed appreciative of prior briefings while clearly understanding no more than half of what was being said to him. Benford spent the morning locked in his office. Even Forsythe couldn't get in to see him. At the first of the afternoon briefings, Forsythe watched with alarm as Benford walked into the room. He was chalk-white and moved slightly bent over as if in physical pain. A heart attack? Forsythe made to rise, but Benford waved him off. He slowly shuffled the papers in his folder. Before he began briefing the senator, he turned to Forsythe and Westfall, leaned close and whispered. His lips quivered. "I ask that both of you make no comment or otherwise display even a mote of surprise or approbation when I brief the candidates. None. Can you do that?" "What does that mean?" said Westfall. "You can't bullshit these candidates." "That's not what he means," said Forsythe in a whisper, divining the truth in a flash. "He's going to save Dominica." "Senator, I have a new development to brief you on, one that I'm sure you and Mr. Farbison will find fascinating," said Benford. They both looked bored. "Another intelligence failure," said Farbison. "What's that make it, a major fuck-up a year on average?" "One a year would be a good year," said Senator Feigenbaum. Benford smiled. "Nothing like that," he said briskly. "It's what we call a crash dive, something quite urgent." "Yeah, everything you guys do is urgent," said Farbison. "I'm sure you'll be interested to know an important asset of ours in Moscow has discovered the identity of a highly placed mole in the U.S. government, but unfortunately cannot transmit the mole's identity due to technical difficulties. We've sent a case officer to Russia to exfiltrate the asset, codenamed Hammer, to report the mole's name so we can arrest the traitor." Benford heard Forsythe's chair squeak, but didn't dare look at him. "How do you intend to get your man into Russia to meet this Hammer?" asked the senator calmly, no alarm on her face. "And how do you propose to spirit him out of the country?" Her decades on intel committees made her familiar with the game, even though she despised and derogated the agency with vigor. "Hammer will be among the guests at a large reception at President Putin's Black Sea Estate," said Benford. "Gaining access will be relatively easy for our case officer, certainly easier than doing this in Moscow. Exfiltration will be accomplished by a Javelin aircraft, a powered stealth glider. The numerous valleys and plains in the area are more than adequate for Stoll aircraft to get in and out. The short takeoff and landing aircraft was all hogwash, but it sounded good." "And where is this Russian mole?" said Farbison, somewhat agitated. Whether from fear or congenital disdain was not apparent. "We do not know," said Benford. "All we know is that he has been active for some time." "I thought you were supposed to be some kind of legendary mole hunter," said the senator. "Maybe he's lost his touch," said Farbison, looking at Benford. "Maybe it's time to turn in your badge." From the back, Forsythe saw Benford's hands shaking. God, what a gamble. What a choice. Deliberately setting up Nate as the ultimate bait. Not even the conspiratorial Russians would consider something so extreme to be a counterintelligence trap. Sacrificing a case officer, for instance, by abandoning him behind the Iron Curtain to save a blown agent had happened before during the Cold War, but an officer had never purposefully been set up to protect a source. They both saw it. Benford's face showed he was trading his soul to sell out Nate. Forsythe knew this was a mortal decision for Simon, one made without the possibility of redemption or exculpation. "We all of us are expendable," Benford had once told Nash. Today, that included Benford's devoir and conscience. The same briefing was given two more times with the other candidates, each with different code names, the classic barium enema trap. Vice Admiral Rowland was told the CIA asset Nate would contact and rescue was encrypted Chalice. She was calm and collected at the news, bored as usual. Ambassador Vano was told the agent was encrypted Chrysanthemum, but his blank stare prompted Benford to mercifully tell him the asset was also known as Flower.
If he is the mole, thought Benford, looking at that handsome profile powered by room temperature IQ, the Russians must be better than we thought. For the three CIA officers, the afternoon was an interminable bad dream, a sightless stumble through a hazy swamp, each of Benford's compounded lies rendered more bitter by betraying Nate. Admiral Roland once perked up at mention of the Javelin stealth glider and asked technical questions about the airframe, the answers to which Benford promised to supply. He silently wondered whether Westfall could research gliders and invent a variant they could call Javelin. By then he hoped it wouldn't matter. As Benford briefed at the front of the room, Westfall leaned over to Forsythe, his own face ashen and eyes wide. "Why not tell Nash ahead of time?" he whispered. "Give him advance warning." Forsythe shook his head. He knew how Benford thought. "The surprise has to be genuine," said Forsythe. "The Russians will be looking for false notes. Besides, Simon knows Nash would have gone in anyway, witting or not. He'll figure it out in the first 10 seconds and sell the deception." "And what happens to Nate?" whispered Westfall. He resented this fall-on-your-sword macho bullshit with these ops maniacs. To deliberately do this to Nate was beyond comprehension to Lucius. "They'll arrest him, interrogate him, and throw him in prison. Knock him around a little, nothing bad. I know Simon will persuade Department of Justice to offer Magnet and Susan and swap for him. The Russians like to get their people back, saves face. Nash will be home for Christmas." "Seems like we shouldn't have to resort to kamikaze missions," said Westfall, staring at the floor. Forsythe gripped his arm. "Whichever of these esteemed candidates is Magnet, my money is on that bottom feeder Farbison. One thing's for sure, they will not fail to report this operation to Yasinevo to save their own ass." "What about the Polish woman, Agnes?" said Westfall. "The Russians will really work her over." Forsythe shook his head. "You notice Benford didn't mention her during his briefings? The Russians won't be expecting another ringer. Nash and Agnes will be arriving with a gaggle of new art students from Warsaw, part of the restoration crew rotation. The Russians will sniff at the students and Agnes, but with Nate in the bag, they'll have only one concern. Who among the 200 guests is the U.S.-run mole? The cryptonym the interrogators use will tell us who Magnet is. Hammer, Chalice, or Flower." "And how do we find out which?" said Westfall. "How do we know this'll work? Benford's previous bait stories never got a rise out of the Russians." Forsythe shrugged. "Not every trap catches a bear," he said. "The mole doesn't report it, no one in Moscow believes it, they decide to wait before acting. Could be anything." "And getting the name back?" "Diva puts a note in the USV," said Forsythe. "Shit house of cards," thought Westfall, selling Nate out for a name. "And Nate's back by Christmas?" said Westfall, doubtful. "Safe and sound," said Forsythe. "And Diva will start reporting the inside scoop on the SVR in the Kremlin right from her director's desk." "Unless a wheel comes off," said Westfall. Forsythe noticed the young analyst was using more operational slang, and he was also correct. Unless a wheel comes off. In Moscow, Gorelikov was busy trying to improve Magnet's chances. He had set in motion two minutely subtle aktivnye metropriatya, active measures, using two agents from the stable of innumerable assets used by the Kremlin for Putin's political influence campaigns around the world. These were favored tactics during the Cold War to spread the communist cant. Now they were designed to sow discord among those who sought to weaken Putin's kleptocracy. Active measures were most effective when the disinformation was woven into a macrame of truth, which effectively obfuscated the deception. The toolbox was diverse: influence elections, disparage opposition leaders, disrupt inimical allegiances, support friendly despots, circulate disinformation, leak forgeries, and in extreme cases, use people like Josip Blokin to eliminate the most tenacious enemies of the state. The attempted assassination of a Polish-born pope in 1981 who was encouraging the Solidarity movement in the Gdansk shipyards was an extreme example of an active measure. A tame journalist named Günter Kallenberger, on Gorelikov's payroll for decades, from the German investigative magazine Der Spiegel, asked for an interview with Senator Feigenbaum's staff chief, Rob Farbison. Aware of Kremlin assessment data on the fatuous staffer, Kallenberger asked Farbison if the senator became DCIA, wouldn't Farbison surely become executive director, or perhaps deputy director for administration? If that was the case, what changes or reforms within CIA could Allied intelligence agencies expect in the coming years? It was a classic journalist's open-ended question. In Russian, luvushka, a deadfall, a snare, designed to give Farbison enough rope to hang himself and his patron. The voluble Farbison did not disappoint. He railed to Kallenberger that CIA had evolved from a post-war collection of has-been Nazi hunters to a feudal and undisciplined anachronistic agency prone to intelligence failures and unable to collect on relevant intelligence gaps. Instead, CIA spent its time and resources trying to suborn Russian code clerks in South America in what he called sex traps. The firestorm that erupted in Congress and Europe and in the indignant editorials in RIA, Novosti, and TASS went on for a week, at the end of which Senator Feigenbaum withdrew her name from consideration for DCIA. Farbison left the senator's staff and became a lobbyist on the Hill for the ACA, the American Coal Association. Concurrent with Farbison's scandalous interview, an article in the Business Standard Financial newspaper in New Delhi reported a new mineral supply contract signed with Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko and IPL, Indian Potash Limited. The article described the chaotic practices of Belarus's state-owned fertilizer group, Belaruskali, which in 2013 caused global prices to collapse, as they had in 2008 and 2009. A sidebar drafted by Gorelikov and obligingly run by a Business Standard editor on Kremlin retainer mentioned that American businessman and former U.S. ambassador to Spain, the Honorable Thomas Vano, had been a member of an international commodities consortium that had benefited from insider tips from the Belarus government to invest in and then short volatile mineral futures. The sidebar piece finished by estimating that the insider trading had netted Ambassador Vano's group $1.5 billion in 2013 alone, profits realized while he was a U.S. government employee, a serious ethics violation. The facts were fudged. No insider tips were given, who in Minsk would confirm that, and the figure of $1.5 billion was a fabrication, but uncheckable, giving the further impression of currency sheltering and tax evasion. Though Vano blithely did not withdraw his name as a candidate for DCIA, the ambassador's nomination was quickly characterized as implausible by the Wall Street Journal and Vozmutitelnye scandalous by Channel 1 Russia in Moscow. In two deft moves, Gorelikov had eliminated the other candidates as realistic contenders. He knew that this theoretically helped the mole hunters at Langley. They'd now be free to concentrate on vetting Admiral Roland, but he was not worried. The Admiral had no detectable flaws in her cover, and the final decision to confirm was imminent. For all CIA knew, one of the failed candidates could be the mole. The Kremlin would swallow its disappointment and would direct their asset to an equally sensitive position elsewhere in Washington. In headquarters, Benford likewise recognized that the obvious hatchet jobs on Feigenbaum and Vano put the spotlight on Admiral Roland, but that was exactly the problem. In the world of counterintelligence, especially with the Russians, nothing was ever as it seemed. Feigenbaum's and Vano's apparent disqualification might actually be an insidious red herring to divert attention, like fake defector Yurchenko sent to protect Ames. The goal would be that while Benford wasted time looking under Roland's bed, the real mole would be free to burrow somewhere else. The NSC, the Pentagon, the West Wing. One hope remained. The center didn't know about Benford's final trap. Admiral Roland did not have an adventure vacation scheduled for at least 6 months. Next spring it was going to be Argentina. She planned to hike in Patagonia because she had discreetly done research on a non-attributable Homeland Security Library computer downtown. It was already brimming with downloaded porn, and had read about Crocodilo Club in Barrio Norte in Buenos Aires that catered to girls. She wasn't sure what that meant exactly, but it sounded interesting. She'd meet Anton in BA and have fun. Then she read about Argentine wine and the food.
There was an Argentine food truck in downtown D.C. that served delicious choripanes, mini grilled chorizo sandwiches with onions and chimichurri sauce. If the little girls in Buenos Aires were as tasty as the street food, she would enjoy herself. But the heady prospect of meeting an exotic Latina lover was overlaid by the shock of this afternoon's CIA briefing. This was trouble, bad trouble, and she needed to talk to Uncle Anton. Not to the center, not to the Kremlin, not to Moscow. She needed Anton. If that unkempt troll, Benford, at CIA was telling the truth, in a couple of days a CIA case officer would be talking to someone named Chalice, who, somehow, knew that Audrey Rowland, Vice Admiral, U.S. Navy, was spying for the Russians, and had been spying for more than a decade. She had to tell Anton, which meant she had to call Susan to pass the message. That evening, she dug her clunky Line T encrypted phone out of the hinged concealment compartment in the arm of a couch in her bedroom, a crappy piece of furniture delivered by the GRU years ago. Big as a brick, it was a location-spooking FIPS-140-2 encrypted secure phone, whose software obfuscated phone position by canceling the device's connection to the nearest cell towers while permitting the call to go through using more distant towers. A call, therefore, from Audrey in Washington to Susan in New York, caromed first to Las Vegas, then bounced through Traverse City, Michigan, to Susan's New York City phone, which would use similar circuitous routing through Cheyenne, Wyoming, to Tarpon Springs, Florida, and back to Audrey in D.C. Susan did not answer her special phone in three separate tries. There was no capability for leaving messages too insecure. So Audrey had to stew all night and finally connect with an irascible Susan the next morning. What the hell was she doing? This was an emergency. Using her admiral's voice, Audrey ordered her hot shit handler to send a flash message to Anton about the imminent infiltration of a CIA officer at Putin's reception to connect with a spy codenamed Chalice. Got that? Chalice, and he's going to fly the mole out on a stealth glider. No, he didn't say from where, but this Chalice bastard knows my name, and once they tell Langley, I'm finished. Do you understand? And I want to meet you in Washington soonest. I've got new information on cavitation propulsion tests, never mind what it is, and more tidbits CIA has been briefing on about recruitments of Russians. That's right, recruitments, and one more thing. I want to be ready to bug out if the CIA guy gets Chalice out of Russia. Yeah, well, fuck authorization, because if they arrest me, I'm going to tell them about a magazine staffer in New York working for Vladimir Vladimirovich, then you'll be swimming the Rio Grande yourself to get to Mexico. You have all that? Do it now. I don't care what time it is there. The CIA guy may already be eating hors d'oeuvres at the buffet table with Chalice. And call me back about our meet down here. Goodbye. Audrey Rowland's orderly mind was not panicking yet, but like any astute scientist, she was watching the gauges carefully to determine the degree of danger and to identify the propitious moment to contemplate flight. This was not the first time there had been a security scare in her 12-year career as a spy. She'd had long discussions with Anton about tradecraft, spying, and the mental discipline required of a mole collecting, storing, and passing sensitive secrets from within a large organization. The intricate discipline appealed to her quantitative brain. The U.S. Navy had many layers of security designed to protect secrets, but no Navy counterintelligence system could conceive of, much less make allowances for, a 3-star admiral and director of ONR operating as a clandestine source for the Kremlin. NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, was ill-equipped to detect the tradecraft nuances of a Russian-run mole. But it was the little gray, rumpled men like that annoying Simon Benford at CIA who were the real danger. Audrey thought it ironic that the famous little mole hunter himself had delivered the warning that would keep Audrey out of trouble. If she was selected for DCIA, the irony would continue. She thought back to her recruitment at the Metropole in Moscow and wondered what had become of the stunning Russian girl who had wet her chin between her thighs so long ago. Certainly she was not a 3-star admiral now. That sexy evening had started the whole thing. Audrey began spying as a way to boost her career, specifically to show the son of a bitch she called Daddy that she could match, no, surpass his own career in the Navy.
As the stripes on her sleeve multiplied, Audrey was confirmed in her belief that she had made the right decision regarding the Russians, despite the initial circumstances. Now she was in danger. Her orderly mind contemplated the odds, and she felt no fear, confident in her own intellect and in Anton's skill. Audrey was ready to leave the Navy, and if she became DCIA, it would mean 2 or 3 or 4 more years of bureaucratic torpor, spectacular gains for Moscow, the collapse of CIA, and continued annuity payments from the Kremlin, after which Audrey Rowland would disappear and retire to a beach somewhere with hot and cold running chosito in sarongs and braided hair. She wouldn't have to be alone anymore. But first, she had to survive this imminent threat to her liberty, and trust that Susan was at this moment speaking to Anton, who in turn was alerting security at Putin's compound, and that both the CIA officer and his confounded mole would be arrested and eliminated, so her secret would remain safe forever. Argentine choripanes. Split and toast small rolls on a griddle until brown. Cut chorizo in half, then in half lengthwise, and grill until caramelized and charred on both sides. Grill sliced white onions until caramelized and finish with a splash of balsamic vinegar. Put chorizo and onions on toasted rolls and slather with chimichurri sauce. Process shredded carrots, parsley, vinegar, red pepper flakes, garlic, olive oil, salt, and pepper in a blender into a thick sauce. Chapter 35. Gall, Not Cheek. Susan's tardy relay of Magnet's urgent warning about the CIA officer who would attempt to penetrate the president's swanky party to contact the mole known as Chalice was received in the center, but was further delayed by the laborious special handling required of all incoming messages from illegals. It finally was forwarded from Yasenevo to the communications unit at Cape Idecopas, where it was read by Gorelikov with a mixture of alarm and triumph. He made a hurried inquiry with the security office. They still had time. The new art restoration shift from Poland was arriving the next morning. He immediately convened an emergency executive meeting in the secure room of the Kamo shack with General Igorova of the SVR, Bortnikov of the FSB, and Patrushev of the Security Council.
"The shloba, the gall of these Americans attempting this at the president's compound," said Bortnikov behind his blue halo. "I could understand it in Moscow, business as usual, but this is too much."
Patrushev had no time for games. His own yellow halo of deceit and cruelty shimmered in the small gray room. He pointed his Cossack's nose at Gorelikov.
"Gall, not cheek. What is so complicated?" he said. "When the American arrives with the Polish contingent, it will be a simple matter to arrest him immediately. Let our colleagues here," he nodded to Dominika and Bortnikov, "arrange a vigorous interrogation, determine the identity of this Chalice, and settle the matter. The American and his mole can share a cell in the Black Dolphin in Orenburg."
Gorelikov had his courtier's face on, so as not to offend.
"I agree with you wholeheartedly, but if you would please indulge me for a moment."
He shot his French shirt sleeves absent-mindedly, revealing magnificent cufflinks of brushed silver and red coral.
"I propose, for your consideration, a discreet alternative to immediate arrest and interrogation, as logical and proper a course of action as it might be. I posit that if we instead let the American roam freely during the 3 days of the president's reception, under constant and strict surveillance, he is likely to attempt contact and unknowingly lead us directly to the individual we seek, the mole Chalice."
Bortnikov, whose FSB surveillance teams were prodigious, liked the idea. More credit for him and his agency if he could bag both the case officer and the mole. Dominika kept her face impassive, but internally she knew this diabolical ambush tactic could blow her out of the water in 48 hours. And she knew something else. It would be Nate Nash who would be coming from Washington. She knew him, and she was certain of it. As good as he was on the street, Nate could be kept under strict control by static surveillance following his every move around the presidential compound through long lenses that would be impossible to spot.
If he made a beeline toward her, convinced that he was black, the game would be over. Something didn't make sense. How had Magnet learned of Nate's mission, and where had the cryptonym Chalice sprung from? She guessed the answer, but could not believe it. She had been doing this